Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that refuses to put the popular in populism. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
This week, we're talking about two bad ways to make policy. And both of them actually come from nascent political projects. One of them comes from the Democratic primary in the US. One of them comes from the new MPs who are off playing Tig in the Independent group. Both of them make me very annoyed. I think basically every registered Democrat in the US is running for president at the moment. So naturally we're going to talk about one of the few high profile Democrats that hasn't actually said he's running for office yet.
As is the way.
And that's Sherrod Brown. Now, Sherrod Brown is a senator in Ohio. Mm-hmm. The thing that made me annoyed is he talked about what real populism is. Sherrod Brown talked about Donald Trump peddling what he called phony populism to distract from the fact that he has used the White House to enrich billionaires like himself. Of course, you have to imagine he's saying it in a gravelly Midwestern drawl. I'm not going to attempt one. Then he also said that real populism isn't racist. And you can tell that this is the kind of climax of the speech because he says real populism isn't in a kind of cut and paste political speech. Right? Real populism isn't racist. Real populists don't engage in hate speech. Now, Sherrod Brown seems to think that populism and somehow that politicians need to be populist and that somehow that is the same as saying we need to have popular policies, which is not what populism is. If we look at what Jan Werner-Muller has said, who literally wrote the book What is Populism? Essentially what he says populism is are people who claim to speak for the majority of ordinary people. So they might talk about the silent majority, they might talk about common sense values, they might talk about ordinary people, real people, like real Americans. Now that doesn't in itself make you a populist. What makes you a populist is essentially the fact that if you represent the silent majority, then your opponents obviously don't represent ordinary people, real Americans, all that kind of stuff. So your opponents are seen as illegitimate. Now you can see that with populist movements across the world. So Viktor Orban in Hungary, for instance, he says his opponents are illegitimate essentially because they're financed by George Soros. They're in the pocket of the George Soros and essentially in the pocket of the Jews is what he's trying to say. Donald Trump talks about paid protesters, talks about the fake media with a grudge against him. Or your opponents are in the play of the deep state and that kind of stuff. So essentially, the thing that populists are is they are anti-pluralist. It's not that they have whiz-bang shiny economic policies that people like. It's essentially they think their opponents are not legitimate. And of course then, if your opponents are not legitimate, you can ignore them. You can incite violence against them. You can shut them down. You can do whatever you like. And what Sherrod Brown then has done is confuse populism with having policies that are popular. You don't imitate the populists. Don't try and pretend that somehow if only Donald Trump wanted Medicare for all or something or wanted to renationalise the railways, that would make him a good politician. The whole point of populism is it's a terrible insidious politics that you don't want to copy.
One thing I would add to that is it's not even just about popular policies. It's just about being popular. That's kind of the core thing here is that so much of populism in and of itself tends to kind of revolve around the cult of personality, around one individual in some form. Maybe not to the same extent that, you know, totalitarian regimes in the past have, but so far there's definitely that element there. The focus on Corbyn and Labour, look at the focus on Farage with UKIP. You name a populist party or a party with a populist element in it, you know, you could almost always be able to associate it with a single individual who's very prominent within that wing or within that party.
And I suppose the thing is that often those populists, are not necessarily popular in and of themselves. So Nigel Farage only got, I think, UKIP's high was about 20% of the vote. Geert Wilders in Holland was only 24% of the vote. They claim to represent the silent majority of ordinary people, but they don't. Instead, and people like Trump, who are populists, they got there essentially by hijacking an establishment party. That's the way they became elected, not necessarily because of their policies.
I mean, what I find quite interesting about Sherrod Brown, though, is that the kind of the part of the Democratic Party that he kind of seems to represent. They have that they are in some ways doing the right thing in that they've identified the problem. That problem being they lost the last election. Why did they lose the last election? Well, we lost the Midwest. Okay, why did we lose the Midwest? Let's look at the voter data. Well, we lost white working class voters. They voted Trump. Well, okay, how can we appeal to those voters? Now, that's where he's coming from. He's trying to make that pitch, which actually, compared to all the other candidates, given he's an Ohio-based senator, if anybody can deliver the Midwest, probably him. But throughout all of this, it's like they've identified the problem. They've found a solution, but it's not necessarily the right solution, because part of it, as you say, is just going to be, well, populism isn't what he's talking about there. Or rather, he's talking about populism in the wrong way. It's something to be emulated. It's not something that anybody who's, you know, of decent mind should be aiming to position themselves as a populist if they're actually meaning it in its literal sense.
Yes, if you're a Democrat with a capital or a small D, you shouldn't be emulating it.
Yeah, absolutely. But even on that front, I feel like he's still missing a beat, because if he's trying to be a populist, there's still an element of it that means you need to be popular within your base. Because as you said, populism tends to do best when it kind of captures a political party rather than trying to rise up itself. And if you were to have a Democratic with a big D populist, well, that person has got to kind of appeal to the Democrat base with policies that are the left-wing equivalent of Trump's wall. Now, what Sherrod Brown hasn't done so far compared to everybody else is come out in favour of Medicare for all and those kind of integral left-wing issues that, you know, are not just popular within the Democratic base, they are popular across the country. It's only really die-hard Republicans of the kind of Tea Party variety who dislike that policy. And yet he's not come out in favour of it. So he seems to be missing a beat that, really, to kind of get anywhere as a populist, you still need to have talking points which are popular, at least within your initial target demographic.
His whole fantasy is wrong. So there's that. So one bad idea is to try and just become a populist. Tell you someone who is not interested in becoming a populist, Steve, and that's Chris Leslie.
Ah, Chris Leslie.
Although he is interested in becoming the British Emmanuel Macron. And one of the things that was talked about when the MPs went off to play TIG a couple of weeks ago was they wanted the return of evidence-based policy into policymaking. And Chris Leslie wrote about this as well in his pamphlet for the Social Market Foundation,
which we reviewed a while back, and it was pants.
It really, yes. The people playing TIG talk about evidence-based policy in and of itself. Now, off the time of recording, they still don't have any policies, so maybe they're just waiting to collect the evidence and come back with their policies. I make it about four main problems with the idea of just saying, oh, we can have evidence-based policy. So let's just run through them. The first objection to the idea of evidence-based policy is the impression you get from someone like Chris Leslie is he's talking about evidence-based policy, essentially to take the ideology out of it. He's trying to position himself, I think, is very much a centrist person in between the ideological people on the left. He doesn't name Corbyn in the pamphlet, but essentially people like him who want to nationalise and take Britain back to the 70s. And then the ideological people on the right who are just trying to go ahead with a disastrous hard Brexit.
And arguably want to take us back to the 1870s.
Yeah. And so essentially the idea is you have evidence-based policy to counteract those two extremes, in a kind of very sub-Tony Blair way. Only problem with that is all policies, like evidence-based policy in terms of the outcome from the policy, what you want as an outcome from the policy is necessarily ideological. So, for instance, Finland had a a trial on universal basic income, and they stopped that. And they, in the report afterwards, they said, well, what we found about UBI was it didn't necessarily get people back into work, but it did make people less stressed.
Yeah, it made people happier, it made them more secure, it was good for their mental health.
Now, whether or not you think that's a good or a bad thing, do you want to bring people back into work or make them happier? That is an ideological question. You need to have an ideological framework to answer.
That's one of the core things when, and it's not just Chris Leslie, it's pretty much anybody, and I've been guilty of this as well in the past, that talks about evidence-led policy, is we use it as a kind of a shorthand for basically saying, we're not going to crack on and carry on with things which clearly don't work, rather than actually meaning it in its proper sense, which should be, we want to achieve outcome X. We want to reduce child poverty to zero in Britain. That's the aim. So in order to have an evidence-based policy approach, is what's the evidence that we can take into account that will help us get there? So is it universal basic income? Is it child tax credits? Is it, scrapping child work laws and so they can all go climb up chimneys again? Like, all of those three are policy areas. One is clearly bullshit. But, it's the sort of thing which somebody could easily argue for if you aren't taking any form of evidence into account.
All right, I suppose you might argue for the repeal of child labour laws if you weren't taking ideology into account.
Yes.
I see. Okay. God, I was worried I just switched off and you were kind of backing slave labour, which would have been interesting. And again, Chris Leslie is obviously taking a lot of his lead from Tony Blair, who was all about, what matters is what works, I suppose. But then it ended up essentially what matters and what worked tended to be what Tony Blair thought was common sense, in that Tony Blair had the ideology and then the policy kind of came after that. Whereas they're putting the cart before the horse, I think, a little bit here.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And I think this is probably one of the problems that the Tiggers are going to have, is that so many of them are vaguely Blairite or outright Blairite in their thinking, and that I would be concerned that they are just going to kind of rehash a lot of the worldview and ideology of Blair, which means they're probably not going to actually have evidence-based policy in any form, even if they've got data to back it up.
So, second objection, I'm quoting Paul Kenny, who's a political public policy academic at University of Stirling, says essentially he's critical of evidence-based policy because there's too much evidence out there at the moment. There's just, and we mentioned this in our last episode actually, that there's so much data out there now, there's so much research. What happens instead, I suppose, is either you resort to shortcuts, so you rely on one piece of evidence that backs up your view, which I suppose is the equivalent of Googling for evidence to try and find what you're looking for to back up your point already, or you cherry pick and rely on one consultant's advice.
One of the other issues, and not just in terms of the amount of data, but actual access to the data itself, it's all very well and good as saying there are academic studies out there on the best ways to reduce child poverty, but unless people have got easy access to them, they're not going to be able to necessarily be informed by that. And access to academic journals is expensive, just prohibitively expensive for the most part, often for no good reason. But that's a separate conversation.
Well, I think the good reason is because those publishers want their profits.
Yeah.
It tends to be university libraries that take out the subscriptions who can afford to just
blaze away their money at it.
Yeah.
But what you then end up in is a situation is, and this isn't necessarily an issue for, like, if you're in government, because I would assume that governments probably have access to these journals in some capacity. But if you're an individual politician or an individual person who's just influenced, interested in a specific area of policy, you go Googling to try and find evidence, you're not able to actually read half of it yourself. So you've got to rely on somebody collating it for you. And, chances are that person is going to be biased in some form. So you're having to get secondhand knowledge of something off of someone else, which may or may not be accurate. And if you don't, especially if you're a politician, you don't have the technical expertise in that area anyway, you're just going to be basically taking the experts, quote-unquote, view on it and just going, right, well, this must be the truth.
And not just individual politicians, but campaigning and lobby groups as well. And I think George Monbiot has made this point in a couple of his books, is essentially a lot of these academic studies, they are made by academics, often funded by public money. Universities mainly funded by public money, but then the public don't have the right to access that data. And I suppose it's a wider point, I suppose, about the kind of open source nature, maybe. And then maybe rather than it being about the bottom line of a few academic publishers, we ought to think about open sourcing a lot of this data.
100%.
Third objection then to the idea of evidence-based policy. Okay, where do you get that evidence from? Usually it's from randomized controlled trials. Now, there's a few issues with those. One of them is they might not be replicable. Just because this policy, this experiment works in this place at this time for this reason, it might not be able to roll out across the country. Another problem is often it might ignore the views of people on the ground and people who are already working in that profession rather than just relying on kind of hard facts. I mean, I think the other problem, I suppose, is those kind of randomized control trials tend to ignore about changing the structures of society. And there's an example in Adam Tooze's book, Crashed, which is about the global financial crisis. And one of the things he starts talking about is the Brookings Institute, which is a kind of centrist policy platform that Barack Obama got a lot of staff from in his White House run. And they were talking about education evidence and looking at things like, how do we keep teacher retention? How do we improve test scores? Where's the best place to try and intervene? Wholesome stuff, really useful stuff. But then a lot of that stuff doesn't then engage with the structures, doesn't engage with the fact that, okay, maybe the fact that you've got kids turning up hungry or with a lack of cultural literacy or with the kind of, with it not engaging with the fact you've got huge levels of income inequality and therefore you don't have equality of opportunity. The fact it doesn't engage with those kind of issues means, in a sense, yes, it might help you for maybe individual schools, but in terms of improving stuff over a wider area, it's got to be more, I think, than just odd trials into the evidence.
Well, there's another couple of issues from my perspective when it comes to randomised control trials. One is just the time it takes to do them. A number of these things, you know, are going to be quite pressing. To do a trials properly, you should be running your first set of trials, looking at the results, then going, okay, we'll do a second set now over here, slightly different variables, slightly different conditions, taking some of the lessons we've learned from the first one, and then see if that works, and then you start rolling it out. Maybe there's even a third or fourth iteration. You're talking years and years and years of all of that, which means eventually, you know, government's probably going to change, and those are just going to get dropped. But then you've also got the fact that, and again, this goes back almost to that first point, that there is the notion behind a randomized control trial is that it has to have a target metric, something that you are measuring to prove that what you're doing is working. And that metric you're choosing to look at is an ideological choice. So going back to that first kind of discussion we had when we mentioned universal basic income in Finland, because universal basic income didn't increase the take-up of jobs in the area it was operating in, it's being presented as a failure. Well, actually, it wasn't a failure at all. If you look at it, the thing that's, I would argue, probably a bit more important, which is making people's lives easier and better and making them less stressed and less prone to mental health issues, which is good for everybody.
I mean, something we've talked about trying to do a podcast on for a while is, what would a society that takes mental health issues as serious as physical disability, what would that look like? And presumably part of it is encouraging policies that make people less stressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the other point with that, as well as the randomised controlled trials being expensive, they are subject to the whims then of individual politicians. So again, we talked about Barack Obama earlier. He set up a lot of randomised controlled trials around the issue, I think it was of teenage pregnancy, how to reduce that. Again, quite expensive, a lot of effort was put in. Goes out of office, Donald Trump comes into office, not really interested in teenage pregnancy, or at least not in that way. So those policies then go down the toilet. You're right, this needs a lot of buy-in. It needs a lot of commitment from governments who may be looking for a quick fix when there isn't one there, but also it's just subject to the pros and cons and whims and wishes of individual politicians, which doesn't help either.
Evidence-based policy and randomised control trials are brilliant if it's not a controversial area, because actually everyone can agree that, you know, child poverty, for instance, is bad, and if there are ways that we can improve it, broadly speaking, we should do it. So you will definitely see kind of like all shades of different governments in the UK engaging with that debate. The issue, though, comes though that the things that are actually going to make the difference are going to be controversial. Because really, if you're just dealing with uncontroversial things, then you're probably just fiddling around at the edges. And you're talking about marginal gains. And again, it goes back to what you said previously about kind of the structures that surround people.
Right, let's take this point and run with that point. So the idea that somehow child poverty, you need evidence-based policy because it's an uncontroversial policy outcome.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's, for instance, look at the Centre for Social Justice and the work that Ian Duncan Smith has done on child poverty. Well, where did they start off with? Why is there child poverty? A lot of it is about family breakdown, which then becomes an emphasis on the nuclear family rather than, say, encouraging other different forms of family, like, say, same-sex adoption or stable single-parent families, that kind of stuff. Also, it becomes about the dignity of work. And so that's why a lot of the worst things about universal credit, the fact that you don't get a payment for a month like you would a normal job, the fact you get your payments monthly rather than weekly because it's trying to ape the idea of being in work, that's some of the worst bits of universal credit that's obviously been come in because they're trying to solve the problem. Then you've also got the structural problem, which we've talked about before, which is you're trying to do that those reforms to help people out of poverty while you're cutting benefits.
Yeah.
In no way you're defending that at all. But I think it's even in an area like child poverty where everyone can agree that child poverty is a bad thing, the fact that you're there looking at it through that kind of lens.
Absolutely. Well, it goes back to that first point. It's the evidence-based policy is ideological because you're trying to achieve X.
Mm.
You define what X is, but it's also, your ideology also defines the way in which you view it. Because somebody like you or me, for instance, isn't going to look at that data or that evidence and say the issue is broken families, because we don't really place that much emphasis on that. But somebody who does is going to look at that exact same data and go, well, all of these come from broken homes.
Yeah, or we're going to say, well, actually, what we mean by a stable family home in the 21st century means very different things to the 30, 40 years ago.
Absolutely. From our perspective, that just boils down to a decent amount of income coming in. There's somebody there to help look after the kids. Doesn't matter exactly who they are. As long as they're there, they're caring for the kids.
I think maybe what the point maybe that Chris Leslie was trying to make. God, look at me. Chris Leslie apologist. The podcast is going downhill. But I think what he's trying to say is there are some areas in which we ignore the evidence in terms of making policy. Maybe climate change is a kind of obvious example, but areas like grammar schools as well, where Theresa May was trying to plough ahead with plans for grammar schools despite the fact that there's no evidence they succeed. In terms of when you're thinking about uncontroversial areas, you would assume actually that's an uncontroversial area. The fact that grammar schools don't work because there's no evidence there, there are only anecdotes, not data in support of them. There's still this kind of myth about them that they are good and wholesome and we need to encourage them among a certain section of the Tory party, and even a couple of progressive kind of commentators like the late Tony Judd as well. We ignore, a lot of that evidence gets ignored. And in that sense, maybe he's right. But I don't think that's just what he means, I think.
Again, I think I said it a bit earlier, is that we tend to talk about evidence-based policy and tend to use it as a catch-all for when the evidence is clearly showing us something doesn't work, we're just going to put it aside and not look at that policy anymore. Grammar schools is a case in point. And, you know, that's not a bad thing by any stretch of the imagination, but that's not all evidence-based policy is. And that's not all it should be if you're doing it properly. We're criticising evidence-based policy quite heavily on this episode, but I don't think either of us would say it has no role in any government policy decisions. Absolutely, it has a place, but you just need to know how to use it properly. If you're not using it properly, it just becomes a meaningless phrase. And I think that's fundamentally kind of almost where Leslie is at the moment. It's a mantra for them at the moment, which might turn into something more meaningful moving forward, or it might not.
Yeah, well, a lot of the articles I read that were critical of evidence-based policy tended to be critical of the kind of nudge units that we've been quite praiseworthy about on previous episodes. And so I think there is a difference between, say, a lot of what the Nudge units are doing, which is sending out different forms of letters to people trying to encourage them to pay their council tax. Yeah, exactly. Like there's definitely a place for that. But again, that's kind of
it's marginal nudges. Gains.
Yeah, exactly. That's not, you're not going to solve child poverty through nudges.
No,
is the thing. Like sometimes you need shoves.
That's a good way to end it, actually.
We call a shove a shove. It's straight talking on this politics. So, right. I've forgotten.
It's the end, actually. Yes.
So, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. If you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, it helps us to get more listeners, even more listeners than Liam Fox's failed podcast. Can we please have that 100 grand, please, Department of Trade? James Cram designed our logo. Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. My Twitter handle is @PaperbackRioter.
And mine is @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.